Welcome to Aging Gayfully. We're about adventure, leisure, travel, being a citizen of the world, traveling to destinations, and being a part of the global community as we age and prosper in body, mind, and spirit.
I am Josh, and I am aging gayfully.
I'm Chris, and I've always been aging gayfully. It just took me a while to figure it out.
Well, me too. I'm relatively new to this whole concept, but I'm very excited about it. However, I'm not excited about the dream that I had last night, and I want to tell you about. I dreamt that I was in one of my favorite places in the world, New York City. For some reason, my wife, Amanda, wasn't with me as I was driving into the city. Yeah. I was going to meet her. I parked the car after searching for a spot for a while, and then I got on the train and I went. I met her. We had a great time. And then it was getting dark, so I had to go find the car. I could not find the car. Now, when I tell you I couldn't find the car, I mean I was in one part of the city, and I knew that my car was in another part of the city, but I could not remember where it was. And it was such a stressful dream. You lose your car in New York City, you are not finding your car again. That's not like, you know, in the Costco parking lot and you just beep on your little clicker until you follow the horn.
Well, that would be, that's almost, that's not a dream, that's a nightmare.
Yes, it is. And as the older and wiser part of this duo here, I want you to translate what that dream
means. As the older and wiser, I wanted to emphasize what you just said there.
Yes, I called you old. Go ahead.
Yes, you did. You did. So yeah, how would I interpret that dream? I interpret that dream as you're ready to explore. You're ready to travel. You're ready to find your way in the beaten path of life.
Oh, well, I mean, that's a rather positive interpretation of a very stressful, anxiety-ridden dream there. So I appreciate that. So here's my question to you. What's the worst you've gotten lost traveling?
Oh, where should I start? Being dyslexic and looking at maps, not a real good combination. I could tell you one of the worst experiences of traveling in one of the most beautiful cities in the United States is Boston. Trying to read the map in Boston, which is pretty much, as I remember it, circular. You know, getting from point A to point B doesn't always end up where you think you're going to end up. So Boston would be, you know, for me is the history, the beauty, the ambiance. But for me, traveling in Boston, my dyslexia goes off the charts.
Now, I wonder, you say it's circular. Do they number their streets and roads, or do they have names for them?
I think that's a little bit of both. It's been a few years since I've been there. But for a dyslexic person like myself, you know, numbers for me, you know, looking at numbers can often be a challenge. And, it may seem like, oh, well, the corner of 53rd and 37th Street. Well, that might sound very easy, but when you often invert those numbers and then you're trying to find it on the map,
right,
it poses for some interesting destinations.
Yeah, like you're in Boston and all of a sudden you're in Philadelphia. I get that.
But here's another one. And this is the art of exploring on a trip to Spain. You know, I flew into Barcelona, spent the night in Barcelona, and I was heading to Cadiz, which is in the southern part of Spain. So we took the regional plane from Barcelona to Jerez de la Frontera, another beautiful city. And it was a very small airport. It was on a Sunday. I had to take the train to Cadiz, which is about a 45-minute ride. All the signage was in Spanish, which it should be. And I'm traveling by myself, which I challenged myself to do this. Went and bought the ticket, and I got to the platform. And of course, there's two sets of tracks, one going south, one going north. And when you can't read the signs, you either have to ask somebody or make a calculated guess. I did pick okay. I did end up in Cadiz.
Oh, good. Dear listener, do you have a story about a time you got lost traveling? Drop us a line. Let us know about it. Maybe we'll read it on the show. Email us at yesiam@aginggayfully.com. So this week, Chris, we're traveling to St. Louis, so I encourage all of you listeners out there, pack your colorful bags and let's go. St. Louis is often referred to as the gateway to the West. Nestled along the western bank of the Mississippi River in Missouri, it holds a rich history. Known for its iconic Gateway Arch, which is a symbol of the United States' western expansion, the city boasts a vibrant art scene, historical landmarks, and diverse neighborhoods. It's home to a range of attractions, including the renowned St. Louis Zoo, the Missouri Botanical Garden, and the Anheuser-Busch Brewery,
which is now owned by a Brazilian company, InBev.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
With a blend of history, modernity, and Midwest charm, St. Louis remains a city of significance in both the regional and national landscape. Now, Chris, we have you on as our St. Louis expert. First question. When I say St. Louis, what food comes to your mind?
Toasted ravioli.
Oh, that sounds delicious. Is that particular to that region?
In St. Louis, the toasted ravioli is deep fried and with a marinara sauce or a meat sauce. And it is a tradition in St. Louis that was established in St. Louis. And right on the hill, which is the Italian section. If you're a baseball fan, you'll recognize this name that grew up on the hill, Yogi Berra. Hall of Fame baseball player, grew up on the hill in St. Louis, Joe Garagiola, also a very famous baseball player and broadcaster. St. Louis is known for a variety of celebrities and food and art. And when you talk about food, toasted ravioli, and then Ted Drew's frozen custard.
Oh, now I want you to describe it in such a way that I taste it.
Ted Drew's frozen custard, you know, it is a St. Louis icon, and one of their signature dishes is the concrete. And what the concrete is, you can put a variety of flavors into the concrete. You can put fresh fruit. They have a number of themed concretes as well. But after all the ingredients are mixed in, you can turn it upside down in the cup and it doesn't come out. And people gather at Ted Drew's after the Cardinal baseball games. You'll see people gathered all around Ted Drew's. It's been in business. It's a family business, probably, I think, 70-some-odd years.
Oh, I love those family restaurants. Okay, second St. Louis question. Besides places to eat, first place that comes to mind?
The first place that comes to mind for me is the old St. Louis Arena, where I was an usher as a high school student and got to go to all the hockey games and concerts and just the ambiance of those old arenas that no longer exist. We've got these, you know, magnificent pavilions and buildings for sporting events and concerts with all the bells and whistles. But there was nothing like the old St. Louis Arena where you were kind of like sitting right on top of the play, and you can hear the organ blasting in the background, and you could just feel like it was a community event. That's what when I think of places in St. Louis, I always go back to the St. Louis Arena, and you can kind of see it. Maybe you can see it in the background behind me. There's a photo there. So they don't make arenas like that anymore.
My last question is, when you think of St. Louis, first memory that comes to mind?
I would have to say the first memory that comes to mind is my family, the rich history that we all have there. And while I haven't lived in St. Louis for a number of years, how you just can go back and fit right in. I grew up in a town called Brentwood in the burbs of St. Louis, and I think of growing up in the burbs and all the friends that you have throughout the years, some that you're still connected with, some that you hadn't seen since when you got out of high school.
When did you move away?
Which time?
Okay, well, then there you go. That's part of your answer.
As we've mentioned before, I've had kind of a cornucopia of experiences, but I've, you know, went to school in Springfield, Illinois, and Milwaukee, been in Florida now pretty much full-time since 2002, three. But there was a period of time where Richard fell in love with St. Louis. And our visits there, he just fell in love with the theaters, with the, you know, our friends, my family. Of course, my four sisters, all they just loved him. And he said to me one day, "Why don't we move to St. Louis?" I looked at him and said, "What? You want to move to St. Louis?" "Yeah. Your family's there. Everybody loves me there." And so, you know, we packed up and, you know, some of those emotional decisions that people are proud to do, you know, we ended up finding just a lovely condo in an old St. Louis City Hospital that had been refurbished. It was kind of like, you know, your eyes are bigger than your stomach. But we went ahead with all these plans, and we ended up moving to St. Louis. You know, we lived there for, at least three years, I think. Maybe, yeah, I'd have to think about that. But he was also diagnosed with esophageal cancer while we were living in St. Louis, that we returned to Florida at his request because he wanted to live out his life, the rest of his life, in his home, in his house in Deerfield Beach, which I have no regrets of doing that for him.
When we were discussing what topics to cover, like St. Louis was one that you definitely wanted to cover. What is it about St. Louis that made you who you are?
Well, I think it's important as we're in the development stages of our Aging Gayfully podcast. You know, I want to be able to give our listeners a little bit of a background about not only where I come from, we want to hear about where you've come from. And I know you're from Miami, and you're a part of this journey as well. But I think for the listeners to get a full grasp of what it means to each one of us to age gayfully, we need to know a little bit of a background. You know, I grew up in St. Louis in a traditional Roman Catholic background, six siblings, a community that everybody pretty much knew one another, but also a community that, in this day and age in the 60s and 70s, where, you know, these topics of who you are, you know, we're all exploring at those, you know, in our teen years and early 20s about who we are and, you know, what path of life we're going to go down. And, you know, that St. Louis was a big part of that. Some good, maybe some not so good. But it's a part of history that I think needs to be talked about, especially when you grow up trying to find your, not only your calling, but your identity as a person. What is your support system? Who do you feel comfortable talking to? Guys like me trying to figure out what their sexual identity is and how do you connect to that? You know, it's challenging. It's challenging in really any setting, but it's very challenging in the Midwest. Doubly so for somebody like, you know, somebody like myself. You know, here's something funny that I'm reminded about what some of my friends have said. Well, you're not the typical gay person. You like sports. You play sports. I said, well, what is all that? She said, you know, what does that mean? I was a pretty good baseball player. You know, I bowled professionally. Most fun I've had at any playing any sport was ice hockey. You know, as a gay person are trying to find, you know, figure out that role, you know, where you're at in life in these very macho environment. And then having that other side of the social work, the ministerial personality that was always there with me. So it was always this kind of dichotomy, this jock who had the soft side to him, who knew what he liked, but didn't know how to obtain it because it was so taboo. And, you know, you pick up on messages from adults. And even though my mom is, I think we talked about this before, you know, she was a woman ahead of her time. She had two college degrees, but, you know, she was born in the 1900s, 1915, I think. And I remember one day watching TV, I was probably 18, 19, and there's something on the TV, and she just blurted out those degenerate gays.
Ugh.
So, you know, when you hear that, you said, oh, well, that's not somebody I'm going to talk to about any of this. Was that a indirect message? You know, these are, again, I'm going back years trying to remembering what the mental gymnastics of that comment, what it did to me. But what it did was it just threw me back deeper into, I would never talk to them about this.
Surely that must have felt like a betrayal.
Yeah. What's the true message behind that? So that's, and even in my 66th year, I still remember that. It's like that whole comment about when people say, well, you know, this is a choice you make. A choice? Why would I choose something that has so many societal negative reaction to it?
Well, even beyond the larger picture of societal, if you find out that, like, if my kid starts to play with matches and I tell him, look, kid, that's very dangerous for you. It'll endanger your life. Absolutely do not do that anymore. And my kid better choose not to play with matches because here at home, I've told him that's not safe. And of course, we crave safety. So why would someone intentionally choose to put themselves in a state of always feeling unsafe? Well, people wouldn't. People would not do that.
Right. And, you know, the jargon that's coming out of some leaders today, you know, is making it unsafe. Every gay person has their own coming out story, and it's unique to them. And there's no two stories that are alike. But we all understand it. One of the reasons about doing Aging Gayfully is just to have these real open and honest conversations as we venture into having guests down the road about what their experience is just as a human being a part of the community. We're really all kind of the same because we crave those three things: love, care, and commitment.
So did you end up coming out when you were in St. Louis?
You know, I spent time in the seminary. We could do tons of shows about that.
Now that you've said that, I'm writing it down.
In the seminary, bowling professionally, you definitely don't want to give that impression. You know, you were going back into the, you know, late 70s, 80s. It's much different now. You know, everything was closeted. The funny thing about it is you think you have this big secret. We don't have secrets. Secrets have us.
Yeah.
We have this camouflage and we think, well, nobody knows, but everybody knows except the person. And what I mean by that is, oh, well, I don't talk about it. I don't bring friends around. You know, those are all the... Those are all the signs. And it was one of my sisters who said to me one day, well, you know, Chris, everybody in the family thinks you're homosexual. I looked at her, and I was in my 20s. So I looked at her and I said, you know, that's amazing. I've never heard any of you come up to me and tell me that you are heterosexual. So why is it a big deal? And her response was, well, it's not a big deal to us. It's a big deal to you.
Yeah.
Because when your mom tells you, oh, those degenerate gays, and you hear all those messaging until you find a group or an organization or some like-minded people where you realize that, you know, you're not the only one. You know, there was no real positive examples from really are the, you know, the three pillars that everybody usually has some form in their life, you know, support at home, support at work, and support with whatever, you know, faith-based community that you might be associated with. When those three pillars are not a positive experience, then that's when self-doubt, that's when alcoholism, that's when drugs, that's when all these other pieces of paraphernalia that happen when you, when you're designated as being different, but you don't feel any different. You're just feeling yourself. And I think that's one of the things that really aggravates me about the conversation that's going on. This is going to be really controversial, but I'm going to go ahead and say it. You know, people come up to me and they, you know, and they want to know about, you know, what it's like being a drag queen or, you know, being trans. And I'm not any of those. I can understand somewhat what goes through those folks' mind, and but I that doesn't mean I can completely understand it myself just because I'm a gay person. You can't, there's just not a whole, there's not an entire explanation for everything because you're gay or you're straight, because we're all people dealing with our own issues and trying to find those three things that love, care, and commitment that we all strive to find in our lives.
It gets really frustrating when you see people categorizing folks according to one part of their existence.
I've had people say, "Well, I couldn't work with you because you're gay." I said, "Well, really?
What do they think's going to happen? Are you going to jump over the desk, drop your drawers, and go? Like,
well, you might hit on me." I said,
"Yeah, don't flatter yourself.
not in your wildest dreams." And I turned that around. I've turned this around to people. You know, you're with a group of guys and they're, you know, you're in a restaurant or you're chumming up with your friends, and in walks a beautiful woman. And what do the men do? They whistle, catcalls, you know, they stare, overtly flirting, some to the point where it's uncomfortable for that person who's on the receiving end. But in their mind, that's perfectly okay because it's normal. Well, you know what? I don't think it's normal to make somebody uncomfortable. I'm not a prude. I'm certainly not a Puritan by any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, what gives you the right to make somebody else uncomfortable just because you feel physically attracted to that person? Why are you entering that person's space? Well, because it's normal. Well, you know, I have my, what's the right word, Josh? I have my image of what I'm attracted to. Could I overtly go and make overtures in a public place? No, nor would I, because it's inappropriate.
Yeah. Did your family, all of your family, come to terms with you as you came out?
Oh, yes. Richard was the mitigating circumstances of that. You know, I introduced Richard to the family as my partner, and we had a coming out party.
Oh.
It was a riot. There was probably about 100 people there. And from all walks of my life, my bowling life, my work life at Catholic Charities, my gay friends, all my siblings. You know, the theme kind of goes back to what my sister said to me, you know, when I was in my, you know, mid to late 20s. Well, everybody in the family knows you're gay. Everybody comes to that their own comfort zone in this process. In some instances, I think it's easier in this day and age because there's more role models available. But then you learn, as I've worked in the gay community, there's not the portrayal of same-sex couples that have been together 30, 40, 50 years. Those committed relationships that are just as meaningful as any other relationship, especially when I was growing up. But when you think about that, how much media was there in the 70s, 80s, 90s? ABC, NBC, and CBS, and maybe an independent station that you grew up with, you know, what kind of diverse news did you get? Now we're probably oversaturated with news, which
we are.
But again, it comes back to those, you know, what were your role models when you grew up? You know, who could you identify with? Well, I didn't see anybody like me until you found that in one of those community newspapers that said, oh, there's a bar you can go to, the support groups you can go to. How do you take those, what to you internally is, you take those risks and reach out because you know you can't do this by yourself. But it's this larger sense of community that we all strive to be a part of and feel welcomed in. That is, you know, that is the key component. Do you feel welcomed in that community?
Well, my hope is that we will build a community around Aging Gayfully. That's my big desire in doing this, is that we gather a bunch of people together and frankly just have a good time as we learn from each other. Emphasis on the good time.
That's really what Aging Gayfully is all about. You're all welcomed in the community. And this is all about, you know, supporting people as we age, and because we're aging from the day that we're born.
It's a car that's just starting to go downhill faster and faster. So we really got to hold on to each other, you know, as the car is going faster and faster. Well, I think that will do us for this week. Chris, in closing, any departing words for you this week?
I think it's time for some toasted ravioli.
Let me tell you something. A big experience for me in the food is also the texture. And while I love pasta, pasta in general can just turn into a whole bunch of mush. So the idea that you have this deep fried crunchiness, oh, that sounds so good. I got to try that.
You're going to love it. And I guess we just have to make a road trip to St. Louis, because I know the best restaurants for the toasted ravioli.
I'm there. Bring the fam. Get ready for the Wilsons, because I think that you just signed up as our tour guide.
We'll have toasted raviolis on the top of the arch.
That's excellent. I love that. How can people get in touch with us?
It's real easy. Just send us an email at yesiam@aginggayfully. That's yesiam at aginggayfully. And we would love to hear some of your stories.
Definitely.
And we'd love to have you on as a guest as we continue with creating our Aging Gayfully community.
Awesome. Well, until next time, I have been Josh, and that has been Chris.
And we're Aging Gayfully.